Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCALP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, July 22nd, 2006. Today, we continue with programming to address the escalating violence in the Middle East. Here's what we have coming up for you. After our News You Need to Know segment, we'll bring you Voice of America and World Report coverage on Lebanon and the area. We'll then have an interview with Dar Jamail reporting from Syria to discuss media coverage, politics, and what refugees from Lebanon are telling him. We'll have commentary on Lebanon by Steve Diamond, and then, in our second hour, commentary by Job Parrish on Iraq. Following that, we bring you an interview with Diane Wilson on her 17th day fasting with a Troops Home Fast campaign in D.C. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news you need to know. We start with a local story from the Portsmouth Herald on July 18, 2006. Lone candidate backs Murtha on Iraq. Carol Shea Porter calls anti-war Congressman John Murtha a profile in courage, but she stands all but alone among Democratic congressional hopefuls in the state. Murtha, a former Marine, Vietnam veteran, and strong supporter of the military in Congress, shocked the country last fall when he said the U.S. could do no more in Iraq and should withdraw. The Pennsylvania congressman plans to speak to Democrats in Hampton on Sunday. The New Hampshire Union Leader asked New Hampshire's congressional candidates whether they agree with Murtha's call for prompt withdrawal. Shea Porter, one of the Democrats hoping to unseat 1st District Republican Jeb Bradley, said she does agree with him. She said, "He has spent time in the Veterans Administration medical centers and talking to retired generals. His view is based on a lot of research." Like Murtha, she believes the U.S. presence in Iraq has inflamed terrorism. "People are looking at us as occupiers." She added, "We're not in a war. We're occupying Iraq. George Bush told us the war ended. We're fighting insurgency. I call that a civil war, and I feel we need to leave." Shea Porter faces State Rep. James Craig of Manchester, David Jarvis of Londonderry, and Gary Dodds of Rye in the September 12th Democratic primary for the 1st District seat held by Republican Jeb Bradley. Craig said he is not privy to enough military expertise and inside information to say whether he agrees with Murtha or not. Until he learns more, quote, "I'm not saying that I agree with Murtha, but I'm not saying that I don't," end quote. Jarvis said setting a date to pull out would be a mistake. Quote, "It was a mistake to invade Iraq. There were clearly no weapons of mass destruction, but we're there and made commitments to the Iraqi people. The stability of the region depends on fulfilling our mission there." End quote. Dodds did not respond to the paper's request for an interview, but he says on his website that he supports U.S. Senator Russell Feingold's call for withdrawing all U.S. troops by the end of this year, starting by pulling them back from the front lines. Bradley agrees with President Bush that progress is being made stabilizing Iraq, and the U.S. should stay the course. Bradley said he opposes setting a timeline for U.S. withdrawal. Quote, "It would serve well the insurgents and the terrorists who are killing American soldiers and innocent Iraqi citizens, and be tremendously disruptive to the new Iraqi government." End quote. On NBC's Meet the Press last month, Murtha made it clear he disagrees with those who advocate staying the course. He said, "We're fighting a war of ideals and ideas. It's no longer a military war. We have won the military war. We toppled Saddam Hussein. The military's done everything that they can do, and so it's time for us to redeploy. Only Iraqis can settle this." He also disagreed with those saying the U.S. is making progress. He hopes Iraq becomes a democracy, but he said, "I don't see it happening." Looking at statistics on violence, oil, and electricity production, roadside bombs, and other indicators, he said, every single measurement that I use is either below pre-war level or is going backward. For our next story, we'd like to start by playing you this clip of Our Leader.
See, the irony is that what they need to do is get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing this
And now this, from Reuters Hollywood Reporter, on Tuesday, July 18th. U.S. broadcasters forced to censor Bush. President Bush's use of the S-word during a supposedly private chat with British Prime Minister Tony Blair Monday forces U.S. broadcasters to follow strict new indecency laws while their cable rivals have no such worries. Cable networks are free to air Bush's quote in its entirety, but broadcast networks risk fines and even their licenses by airing it without bleeping the word. Bush's candid remark to Blair was picked up by an open microphone during the closing lunch at the Group of Eight summit in Russia. Bush told Blair as he chewed on a buttered roll, "See, the irony is that what they need to do is get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing this. And it's over." One executive quipped, "I guess the FCC has performed a new feat by forcing broadcasters to censor the leader of the free world." Under commission decisions and court rulings, material is indecent if it, quote, "depicts or describes sexual or excretory activities or organs in a patently offensive manner, as measured by contemporary community standards for the broadcast medium," end quote. Under a new law signed by Bush this year, broadcasters face fines of up to $325,000 per incident. Here's that quote again, and do note, we too must bleep.
See, the irony is that what they need to do is get Syria to get Hezbollah to stop doing this
And another article on that same conversation from Reuters UK on July 18th. Yo Bush, Blair mocked as U.S. poodle. Prime Minister Tony Blair was roundly mocked as a U.S. poodle on Tuesday after an off-the-cuff chat with President George W. Bush was accidentally broadcast. Bush and Blair enjoyed a gossip over lunch at the Group of Eight summit in St. Petersburg on Monday, unaware that a microphone in front of them was switched on and their words would be relayed around the world. Breaking with diplomatic formalities, Bush hailed Blair, his closest European ally, with the words, "Yo, Blair!" His solution to the Middle East crisis was that Syria should press Hezbollah to stop doing this. The media pored over the text of the conversation, saying it cast Blair in a subservient role and showed the unequal nature of Britain's much-vaunted special relationship with the U.S. But most damaging to Blair was what commentators saw as his plea, rebuffed by Bush, to be allowed to visit the Middle East to try to stop fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. Blair suggested he could prepare the ground for U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice because, quote, "If she goes out, she's got to succeed, whereas I can just go out and talk," end quote. One newspaper said, "He sounds less like the head of a sovereign government than a Bush official waiting for the boss's green light, which he does not give." Blair has been Bush's most trusted ally, putting his political future on the line by backing the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, despite rows with European allies and fierce political attacks at home. The Independent described a spurned offer to act as peacemaker as a setback for Blair, who was under pressure from within his own party to set a date to step down. Wynn Grant, politics professor at Warwick University, said the conversation suggested, quote, that perhaps Blair doesn't have the kind of relationship with Bush that he would sometimes like to claim he has, end quote. But he said the conversation only reflected reality. The U.S.-UK relationship throughout the whole period since World War II has always been an asymmetrical one. It's always been one in which the U.S. has been dominant. Now, as we look deeper into the situation in Lebanon, let's look back on what U.S. officials were saying about Lebanon last autumn with this Voice of America broadcast from September 21, 2005. If you are unfamiliar with the Voice of America, it is an international multimedia broadcasting service funded by the U.S. government through the Broadcasting Board of Governors. VOA broadcasts more than 1,000 hours of news, informational, educational, and cultural programs every week to an audience of more than 100 million people worldwide.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the United Nations in New York City, representatives from the United States, Britain, Egypt, the European Union, France, Italy, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and the UN gathered to demonstrate their support for the new government of Lebanon. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan and others pledged financial and other assistance to help Lebanon recover from nearly 30 years of civil war and foreign interference. Mr. Annan says, "The international community remains steadfast in its determination to ensure that outside actors end all interference in the domestic affairs of Lebanon." U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice offered this comment.
Syria needs to get on the right side of the events that are going on in the Middle East. That means to cut off the routes that insurgents are using to use Syrian territory to penetrate into Iraq and to kill innocent Iraqis. That means to close off support to Palestinian rejectionists, who are the single biggest threat to progress in the Israeli-Palestinian rapprochement. And again, to make certain that nothing is being done to interfere in the affairs of Lebanon.
Ms. Rice says that Syria should cooperate with the investigation of the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, an opponent of the Syrian occupation. Mr. Hariri and 20 others died in a February bombing in Beirut, Lebanon's capital. The widespread protests that followed forced Syria to withdraw its troops, which had been present in Lebanon since 1976. Several former top Lebanese government officials, including Ali Haj and Mustafa Hamdan, are in custody in connection with the bombing. Ann Patterson, the deputy U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, says, "These gentlemen who have been arrested do have long-standing ties with Syria." In June, the Lebanese completed the third round of parliamentary elections. The anti-Syrian opposition, led by Saad Hariri, Rafik Hariri's son, won a majority of 70 out of 128 seats. The new Lebanese government is committed to political and economic reform. Secretary of State Rice says, "The U.S. is going to support the Lebanon government as they move forward."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
You're listening to Making Waves. And we now bring you the World Report from July 17th that will help us put together the past week's events in Lebanon, Palestine, and Israel.
Last Wednesday, Hezbollah crossed the UN blue line in southern Lebanon, killed 3 Israeli soldiers, captured 2 others, and demanded the release of Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails. Hezbollah's attack broke the UN rules in southern Lebanon. Geir Pedersen, the senior UN official in Lebanon, called it a violent breach of the blue line. It provided the occasion for Israel to open up a second front in Lebanon, parallel to the similar operation that has been delivering air and artillery strikes for the last couple of weeks in Gaza. Writing from his home in Beirut, Robert Fisk describes how he could hear the jets all night long, quote, "whispering high above the Mediterranean. It lasted for hours," he says, "little fireflies that were watching Beirut, waiting for dawn, perhaps, because it was then that they descended." He writes that they came first to the little village of Dwer near Nabatea in southern Lebanon, where an Israeli plane dropped a bomb onto a home of a Shia Muslim cleric. He was killed. So was his wife. So were 8 of his children. Also writing from Beirut, The Guardian's longtime correspondent David Hurst lamented that Lebanon had been plunged back into the role it endured for a quarter century and more, that of hapless arena for other people's wars, as well as pawn in the ambitions and machinations of regional players far more powerful than itself. From Jerusalem, Haaretz correspondent Zvi Barel didn't see it that way. he accused Lebanese commentators of being far from attributing to any Lebanese government the ability to disarm Hezbollah or to deploy its forces along the southern border. Therefore, he concludes that all eyes are turned to the secret talks between Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iran, and Lebanon, and less so to the Security Council deliberations. Rami Khoury, a regular contributor to Beirut's English-language Daily Star, wasn't ready to let the U.S. off the hook so easily. Quote, "You need to understand the relationship among four pairs of actors to grasp the meaning of the escalating attacks by Hamas and Hezbollah and Israel," he says. "The four pairs are Hamas and Hezbollah, the Palestinian and Lebanese governments, Syria and Iran, Israel and the United States." Simplistically, U.S. President George W. Bush has depicted this latest round of war as a clash between good and evil, while the Israeli government has tried to blame Palestinians and Lebanese, who only want to make war, against a peace-loving Israel. The more nuanced and complex reality is that all the actors in the four pairs collectively play a role in the ongoing fighting, as we witness the culmination of four decades of failed policies that have kept the Middle East tense, angry, and violent. End quote. On his way to the G8 meeting in St. Petersburg, Prime Minister Stephen Harper told reporters, quote, "I think Israel's response under the circumstances has been measured." End quote. From the reports we get here, you would never guess how little agreement there is about the details. Fisk speculates that prisoner swaps is probably all that will come of this, and points out that such exchanges between Israel and Lebanon have a long history. Fisk concludes that the Lebanese and Israelis know how this cruel game is played. How many have to die before the swaps begin is a more important question. Peace activist and former left-wing member of Knesset Uri Avneri insists that the real aim is to change the regime in Lebanon and to install a puppet government. That was the aim of Ariel Sharon's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, he says. It failed, but Sharon and his pupils in the military and political leadership have never really given up on it. As in 1982, the present operation, too, was planned and is being carried out in full coordination with the U.S. As then, there is no doubt that it is coordinated with a part of the Lebanese elite. That's the main thing. Everything else is noise and propaganda. End quote. On the other front, in Gaza, the idea that whatever the fate of the captive soldier Gilad Shalit may be, the Israeli army's war in Gaza is not about him, was confirmed by security analyst Alex Fishman, writing in Yediat Aharonot. Fishman, who favors the elimination of Hamas, says that the army was preparing for an attack months earlier and was constantly pushing for it, with the goal of destroying the Hamas infrastructure and its government. The abduction of the soldier released the safety catch, and the operation began on the 28th of June with the destruction of infrastructure in Gaza and the mass detention of the Hamas leadership in the West Bank, which was also planned weeks in advance. Ismail Haniyeh expressed much the same idea a week later in an article for the Washington Post. Corporal Shalit, he said, is only a pretext for a job scheduled months ago. Karen Kwiatkowski, a retired U.S. Air Force lieutenant colonel, recalls the strategic vision in a paper written for Benjamin Netanyahu by Richard Perl and a number of influential American neoconservatives. She argues that that paper, called A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, is the key to understanding Israel's current security policy. Back in Beirut, Fisk points out that in past violence of this kind, Syria's power was controlled by Hafez Assad, one of the shrewdest Arabs in modern history. But there are those, including Lebanese politicians, who believe that Bashar, the son, lacks his late father's wisdom and understanding of power. Similar questions have been raised about Ehud Olmert. Writing in the conservative Jerusalem Post, David Horowitz says, many outside commentators have loudly wondered over the weekend whether a government led by military veterans such as Ariel Sharon or Yitzhak Rabin would have responded to Hezbollah's cross-border onslaught last Wednesday in the way that Ehud Olmert and Amir Peretz have. The answer, he concludes, is almost certainly yes. A more challenging question, according to Horovitz, is whether Nasrallah would have dared authorize the attack had a Sharon or Rabin been in power. Israeli PM Ehud Olmert is not well known outside Israel. At 60, he is a lifelong politician who was first elected to the Knesset at 28. He officially became prime minister in April, but had been the acting PM since January when his mentor, Ariel Sharon, suffered a massive stroke and was incapacitated. Even those who hated Ariel Sharon recognized him as a rare individual, especially so when compared to others in that small group of generals who try their hand at politics. He was a far better general than, say, Colin Powell, brilliant, idiosyncratic, equivocal, brutal, and he was a successful politician. One thinks of Eisenhower, de Gaulle. He got away with frequent acts of insubordination and deceit against his superiors. Although he was forced to resign as defense minister after the inquiry into Sabra and Shatila, he was still the individual who made facts on the ground a household phrase. On the other hand, Ehud Olmert is a municipal politician who inherited the master's most ambitious endgame. His military training, especially when compared with almost every other Israeli leader, has been brief. He was injured during his compulsory military service and released early. He completed his military duties as a journalist for the Armed Forces magazine and was a military correspondent during the Yom Kippur War in 1973. However, speaking of Israel's other prime ministers, Time magazine describes Olmert as probably the best politician of them all. A lawyer, a deal-maker, and an inside man, he is a former finance minister and minister of trade and development. He spent two terms as mayor of Jerusalem, concentrating on development and transit issues. As mayor of Jerusalem between 1993 and 2003, he advocated expanding settlements in the West Bank surrounding the city. His Israel is a modern democratic society, not a biblical reenactment. He calculated that Israel couldn't rule the Palestinians in Gaza and remain a democracy. In November 2003, he gave a speech foreshadowing Sharon's disengagement plan. Soon after, he gave his views in an interview. Quote, "We are approaching the point where more and more Palestinians will say, 'We have been won over. We agree with Lieberman. There is no room for two states between the Jordan River and the sea. All we want is the right to vote.' The day they do that is the day we will lose everything," Olmert said. "Even when they carry out terror, it is very difficult for us to persuade the world of the justice of our cause. We see this on a daily basis, all the more so when there is only one demand, an equal right to vote. The thought that the struggle against us will be headed by liberal Jewish organizations who shouldered the burden of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa scares me." End quote. Israeli PM Ehud Olmert speaking in 2003. Olmert lacks the military experience to get away with floating like a butterfly, so we probably will see a lot of stinging like a bee. That can have a devastating effect on the home folks, especially if the war isn't over quickly. Israeli actions in Gaza and Lebanon seem to be similarly designed. In both cases, air and artillery attacks were first unleashed to cut transportation routes and cordon off key areas. The army is now moving in to tighten the noose. In fact, these are textbook invasions. The generals are in charge. The most obvious problem with this kind of maneuver is the civilians killed in bombardments or cut off from supplies like water and food. Olmert may be politically savvy enough not to dismiss civilian deaths as collateral damage, but to understand them as a terminal liability in fighting fourth-generation war. That's it for this Monday. This edition of World Report has been archived on the World Report website at cjly.net/worldreport. You can get it either as a podcast or in raw MP3 format. There is also a link to a text version of the broadcast. To comment or suggest a story, send email to earthling@cjoy.net or by snail mail to Box 767, Nelson, British Columbia, Canada, V1L5R4. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.
عطيتك أكتر ما في لا ما تقلي لو روق علي شوي مشيني على ضو عطيتك أكتر ما في لا ما تقلي لو شو يلي صاير فيك شو يلي بيرضيك على بعضك خليك وخليني بالشو شو يلي صاير فيك شو يلي على بعضك خليك وخليني بالجو روق علي شوي مشيني على ضو روق علي شوي مشيني على ضو عطيتك أكتر ما في لا ما تقلي لو شو يلي طاير فيك وشو يلي بيرضيك على بعضك
That was artist Maya Nasri from Lebanon singing Kalini Bilagio. We now bring you this interview with Dar Jamail, who reports on what terrified refugees from Lebanon are telling him about what the Israelis are doing. He looks at media coverage, politics, and reactions to war regionally.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Journalist Dar Jamail joins us from Damascus, Syria, to talk about the climate there as Israeli F-16s bomb Lebanon and make their way along the Beirut to Damascus highway towards Syria. Dar Jamail covered the Iraq war and occupation during 8 months, reporting on the early stages of war and occupation, covering two sieges of Fallujah in 2004 through the 2005 elections. You will find his work in The Nation magazine, Interpress News Service, and many other publications. His website is darjamailiraq.com, DarjamailIraq.com. Dar, let's talk about the climate in Syria right now. I understand there have been some big demonstrations there.
Yesterday there was a massive demonstration here in Damascus. I don't know exactly how many people, but I think it would be safe to say it was well over 100,000. And it's really not a surprise because the government of Syria and most of the people of Syria very much support Hezbollah's right to existence. Over here in the Arab and Muslim world, they're not viewed as a terrorist organization. They're viewed as a legitimate political, albeit militant group now. They do have a seat in the cabinet in the Lebanese government. They have many seats in the Lebanese parliament. Their party has been fully engaged in its formation in 1985 of social welfare programs, building hospitals, education, this sort of thing. So they sort of filled a gap left by the inability of the Lebanese government to help the impoverished Shia in southern Lebanon. And so therefore, in that area, as well as Syria, Iran, and so many other countries in this region, they do have very much support, and that is the mood here in Damascus. I just walked back from dinner, and there's Hezbollah flags flying in front of shops, cars driving down the street, but Hezbollah flags flying on the antenna, and the demonstration yesterday showed that. And not only was there demonstrations here in Damascus, but also up in Latakia, a larger city up north on the coast, and several other cities around Damascus as well.
Major U.S. TV networks, Fox, CNN, MSNBC, and others are passing on Israel's remarks that the bombing of Lebanon is a kind of service of freeing the people from Hezbollah.
This is simply propaganda, and it's really not a surprise that propaganda outlets like CNN and especially Fox really toe the Israeli line as far as acting as good mouthpieces to get that information out to people in the West, which this is really the stated goal of this Israeli program of collectively punishing the entire country of Lebanon because of Hezbollah. It's their goal that they want to do this to put pressure on the Lebanese government to try to have them kick Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon. And in fact, that's one of the precepts they say that has to happen before they stop this attack, which basically guarantees that it won't stop, because the Lebanese government really can't do much of anything. It's much like the Iraqi government. It's very sectarian, very factionalized, and no one group has much power. So getting them to agree on anything, let alone such a critical issue of Hezbollah, is just not going to happen. So as these media outlets continue to propagandize this Israeli plan, it's certainly not the case on the ground in Lebanon. Let's be real clear, Hezbollah has the majority support of most people in Lebanon. Over 60% of the country is Shia Muslim, and that is the base of Hezbollah. And they even are respected by much of the Christian community and much of the Druze community there as well. So saying that they're trying to split the country, sort of the divide Lebanon into submission to free the people. Dora, you and I have talked from Baghdad about this same type of policy that the United States has instituted in Iraq, where it's basically bombed the country into oblivion, bombed them to freedom, destroy the village to save it. It's the same type of rhetoric we've been seeing since Vietnam, and it's complete lunacy. Bottom line is, dropping bombs on a country does not split it up. It does not cause the people to start fighting amongst each other so much as it does cause them to gel together to oppose the enemy. And even the Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri's son, who is now the majority leader of parliament, said 2 days ago from Kuwait that Israel is the enemy, that the enemy is not Hezbollah, the enemy is not from within, it's not a particular faction or sectarian group in Lebanon. Rather, the enemy is Israel, and that's what we're seeing, that as the bombs continue to fall and Lebanon is bombed into the Stone Age, now most of their critical infrastructure is gone, so many civilians being killed and wounded every single day, the outrage is aimed at Israel, the people dropping the bombs, rather than Hezbollah.
Prime Minister Ehud Olmert in Israel has said he will continue attacking until Israeli soldiers are freed and until Israelis are free from rocket attacks from Lebanon and Hezbollah at the border.
It's simply violence begets more violence. And if we simply look at the cause of events, we see that there were no Hezbollah rockets slamming into train stations in Haifa and killing Israeli civilians until the Israeli military began to collectively punish the entire country of Lebanon, knocking out critical infrastructure, killing over 200 civilians. There's been right now a maximum of 14 Lebanese soldiers killed. All of the rest of over 220 people now killed are civilians. This is what is causing Hezbollah to respond in kind. Another thing I should point out is that the Israeli military, if you do the math and look at the number of Lebanese civilians killed compared with the number of Lebanese army men that have been killed, it's a 16% ratio of how many military people are being killed out of all that are being killed. Consequently, if we look at Hezbollah and the rockets they fired into Israel, which has been over 400 now, and there's been 24 Israelis die, 12 of those are military and 12 of those are civilians. So not to justify it or not to approve of it, but that's a 50% ratio as opposed to Ehud Olmert's position of collectively punishing an entire country, and in the process, only 16% of the targets being military targets. And them using this rhetoric of we're going to go to the end, we're not ruling out the possibility of a ground invasion, certainly only guarantees that more of the same is going to happen, where more of Lebanese critical infrastructure will be destroyed, more civilians will be killed, and in response, Hezbollah will launch, of course, many, many more rockets into Israel, therefore guaranteeing that more Israeli civilians will die, and therefore guaranteeing that this crazy policy that Israel is engaged in is only going to continue. It's once again that insane cycle of violence where as more people die, the rhetoric gets cranked up even more, and unfortunately this is only going to continue for the coming weeks, if not months, if not longer.
Dar, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria was on Democracy Now! Tuesday, July 18th, and he said that he'd contacted U.S. leaders to offer help after 9/11, and that Syria, in fact, provided intelligence on al-Qaeda, which helped to protect the U.S. from further attacks. We had also heard Ron Suskind on Democracy Now! Confirming that Syria offered sensitive intelligence to America on al-Qaeda. So why didn't Syria become America's ally in the war on terror after 9/11, after these kinds of overtures were made?
Even if we look back to the 1991 Gulf War against Iraq, Bush Sr.'s war against Iraq, we had Syria on board in that coalition, which is why the U.S. green-lighted Syria to go ahead and occupy Lebanon, which they did until just a little bit over a year ago. They only occupied Lebanon because the United States gave us the green light to do so. And then we flash forward up to the very important events that you mentioned that Assad has said in the past as well, that they did give the U.S. very valuable information about al-Qaeda groups planning terrorist attacks. They have even allowed the U.S., the CIA, to use extraordinary rendition to fly people here to be tortured. So they've been quite complicit with the U.S. in their so-called war on terror. But things changed during the invasion of Iraq when this time Syria refused to join the coalition of the so-called willing, therefore became sort of a sub-country of the Axis of Evil. So they certainly are part of that now simply because of the fact that they would not aid and abet the United States in invading and occupying Iraq. So now they are paying the price, despite the fact that this country has done what it can to help the U.S. prevent terrorist attacks. And I think it's really as simple as that.
I understand that you have been talking with a man, a 25-year-old construction worker, who says he saw a hospital bombed in Lebanon. Just talk about what these refugees are telling you.
Collective punishment means basically everything is become a target now. The Geneva Conventions are out the window. And when I was at the northern border, I interviewed a 25-year-old American citizen. His name is Abdulrahma. He's a social studies teacher. He was vacationing in Beirut with his family, and they were all living in an apartment building nearby the UN building in downtown Beirut. He told me there were so many bomb calls around the city, and they were all bombing civilians. He said, you know, if Israel wants to attack Hezbollah, fine, let them attack Hezbollah, but not the civilians, because all they're doing is attacking the civilians in Lebanon. He was outraged. He was practically yelling responses as I asked him questions. And he said, we lived in sheer terror. We hadn't slept for 3 nights. Every bomb that fell, we wondered if it was going to collapse our building. We wondered when the next one was going to come and if it would hit us. This is terrorism. We are terrorized. He said that very, very clearly. When you bomb a country into oblivion, you bomb Beirut into oblivion, that is blatant terrorism of the civilian population, and that is another violation of the Geneva Convention. Al Jazeera reported that a convoy of ambulances was hit with missiles from either warplanes or helicopters. Other people, so many people have told me that they've seen hospitals bombed. I've been to the western border of Syria, the eastern border of Lebanon, about 5 days ago, and then just 2 days ago, I was up on the northern border of Syria and Lebanon. And in both places, people were coming out, and this is at different times. This is about 3 days apart. In both times, I ran into several people at each border coming out. They were all saying the same thing, that they were seeing influences bombed, they were seeing hospitals attacked. Most of the damage being done was against the civilian population, while certainly the Al-Manar Hezbollah television station has been hit in some of the Hezbollah infrastructure. Again, if you simply look at the images on TV and listen to what the people are saying coming out of Lebanon, most of the damage being done is against hospitals, it's against ambulances, and the civilian population. I think it's important to be very, very clear about this. The Geneva Conventions were designed, they were born in order to protect the civilian population the best they could during a time of war. So these tactics of collective punishment that we saw in Fallujah and now that we're seeing in Lebanon are grave breaches of the Geneva Convention, targeting civilians, doing indiscriminate bombings, targeting hospitals and ambulances. These are very, very grave breaches of the Geneva Convention. These are war crimes. People like Prime Minister of Israel, Ehud Olmert, those who support him, primarily, of course, all of his military, but the U.S. government, who provides over $2 billion a year in aid to Israel, much of that in military hardware. Israel has the largest fleet of F-16s outside of the United States of America because the U.S. supports it so much. So that basically means the U.S. government has been aiding and abetting Israel in these war crimes, and of course that's underscored by the fact that recently George Bush has said, well, of course Israel has the right to so-called defend itself. A ceasefire resolution was put forth in the U.N., which was vetoed by the United States. Basically, 7 of 8 last vetoes to occur in the U.N. have been by the U.S. when it has stood up to defend Israel's policies, which tend to take the shape of war crimes, whether it be now in Lebanon or right now in the Gaza Strip or in the past in other areas of the occupied Palestinian territory. So it's an atrocity that we're witnessing right now. We are watching an entire country collectively punished. It's on all the major media, and the world is standing by and watching it and letting it happen, and is completely impotent because of this fatal design of giving countries like the United States veto power. What kind of a democratic institution is that when over 150 countries belong to it, and there's 3 or 4, I believe, if I recall correctly, who have veto power? That's absurd, and that's why these atrocities are going to continue to take place, and why. Right now, it looks like there's nothing anybody can do to stop it.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. Talk about the issue of Israel's claims that the rockets and weapons that Hezbollah has were provided by Iran and or Syria.
There were even claims that there were Iranian Republican guards in southern Lebanon, which is absolutely untrue. But without a doubt, Hezbollah has either bought or been provided with weaponry from Iran. But we can say the same thing of the U.S. providing arms to Israel. So then, therefore, that would make the U.S. a legitimate target by Hezbollah or anyone else who might choose to support them now, wouldn't it? If we apply this same logic that Israel is using against Hezbollah and now saber-rattling towards Syria and Iran, well, why don't we turn that around? And we could say, well, anyone that is supporting Israel then is also a target, and they're supporting a terrorist organization. Because what Israel is doing is terrorism. This rhetoric that a state can engage in terrorism by the air, by using F-16s to civilian populations, drop 500-pound bombs in the middle of the city center, bomb hospitals, rocket ambulances, killing women and children, that is flashing across TV screens over here in the Middle East every single day, every single hour of every single day. And yet when Hezbollah fights back using rockets, of course, firing into civilian populations is also a war crime, but when they fight back, generating not nearly the number of casualties, that's terrorism. It's quite the double standard, and people in the West have to understand that over here in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, it's seen as the hypocritical thing that it really is, because Hezbollah certainly has a right to defend itself. Lebanon, especially as a country, as a sovereign country now that is being bombed, and Israeli ground troops yesterday pushed into southern Lebanon for a bit and then back out, as a sovereign country, certainly has a right to defend itself. So by Israeli U.S. logic, is the Lebanese army then a terrorist organization simply because it's fighting to defend their own country? It's really absurd rhetoric, and it's one of these things that back in the West, when a terrorist strike happens, people, like in 9/11, during 9/11, people said, well, why do they hate us? Well, this is why they hate us, because this blatant hypocrisy, this unbridled support of Israel, that they occupy Palestinian territories as they kill civilians daily, and now as they collectively punish an entire country. Should add that Lebanon is, of course, an Arab country as such, and that's why this is generating such outrage around the Middle East.
We see leaders in various countries respond to all of this in either militant tones to match Israel and the U.S., or some are criticizing Hezbollah, Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, Jordan's King Abdullah, Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak. But then people in many of these countries appear to feel differently. Maybe there are differences within the governments. Would you say that you're seeing the political power base separate from some leaders? Are there divisions forming? Is it the case that the policies may seem unstoppable right now because the decisions were made behind closed doors and away from the people?
Well, you make a very good point, because the fact is there's a huge disconnect between the rulers of these Arab countries like Egypt, like Jordan, like United Arab Emirates, like on down the line, Iraq, where the bottom line is that these rulers are certainly not representing what the people want them to do, because I really can't underscore hard enough how much outrage there is around the Arab world that Israel is attacking Lebanon. Israel is viewed as the Zionist country that is occupying Arab land and shouldn't have been there in the first place. That's how they're viewed in the Arab world. So now that they're launching an act of aggression against Lebanon, an Arab country, there is widespread outrage across the Arab world. And then when you contrast that to these Arab leaders like Hosni Mubarak and others of his ilk, and especially King Abdullah of Jordan, who is one of the finest American pawns out there, that absolutely won't certainly condemn what's happening and won't certainly do anything like consider sanctions against Israel or something a little bit more tangible that might actually have an impact instead of doing some reflecting and maybe clicking their tongues on top of their mouth and saying, well, this is just too bad, and you know, it's certainly Israel should use restraint, and basically mirroring the rhetoric that we see coming out of the G8, that ridiculous G8 conference that's going on right now. And that disconnect is another very worrisome thing, because there are massive demonstrations. They're getting bigger as time goes on. The governments are doing nothing about it. Contrasted with Israel, it does seem that while there are protesters in Israel, while there are certainly hundreds of thousands of people in that country opposed to what their government's doing, it's like they're opposed to their government carrying out military operations in the Palestinian territories, let alone occupying it. Still, when a country goes to war, at least the beginning of it, like we've seen in our own country, people do tend to tell around the president, kind of wave the flag, make the eagle scream, you know, patriotism, nationalism, it all goes haywire for a while. And that's what we're seeing in Israel right now, where we're afraid. There's terror raid sirens going off daily around cities in Israel. Many people are now living in bomb shelters, not a fun existence. So, of course, people are hoping the government will protect them and support them in using this overkill military style that they're using in Lebanon. But that's really the one country where I would say that the government is doing what the majority of people want it to do, contrasted with the Arab countries where there is a massive disconnect, and the Arab leaders are condemned and scoffed at by both people in the population of their countries. And in fact, when I went to the western border of Lebanon about 5 days ago, I interviewed one man who had been in there vacationing from Kuwait, who was also very upset at the leader of his country, and basically said, I'm leaving Lebanon because this is never going to stop until the Arab leaders move, and nothing will change until they do something that really has real consequence against the Israeli government. And that is the outrage that is commonplace here now in the Middle East.
Many of us are just searching for news on the internet and through various sites. What, if anything, are Lebanese and Syrians and others seeing and hearing on Arab TV networks that comes from perhaps Hezbollah itself, from Assad Abu Khalil and others in the picture, or perhaps from those in Hamas who are also dealing with Israel in the Palestine-occupied territories?
Yes, the Al-Manar television station that I mentioned earlier, it was bombed by the Israelis, but they failed to knock out the bunker that Al-Manar had underneath their building. So that TV station is still broadcasting. And that is quite a popular station. It's very common here in Damascus or Latakia or other cities around Syria that I've been to. So I walk into a hotel and see that the person in the lobby sitting there watching Al-Manar. I went out to eat at a restaurant tonight, and lo and behold, there's Al-Manar on televisions in that restaurant. So that is a very common channel here in Syria, and also in other places around the Middle East, and They're showing, of course, reality on the ground. They're showing the women and children. Of course, a lot of Al-Manar is just simply Hezbollah propaganda, and it's simply not worth watching. But more importantly than Al-Manar, though, is Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera has a very strong presence in Lebanon. They have scores of reporters there. They are broadcasting from Beirut. They're doing a very fine job of covering it. They are interviewing Israeli military officials as well, and also covering the situation in Israel. But in Lebanon, they are doing a fine job of getting people out to the scenes where these bombs are happening. So that translates to what people here in the Middle East are seeing is the result of this collective punishment of Lebanon by the Israelis. They're seeing the dead women and children. They're seeing the blown-up ambulances, the completely destroyed hospitals. They're seeing grain silos that have been rocketed by Israeli warplanes. They're seeing the new lighthouse that had recently been built on the Lebanese coast in Beirut that was rocketed by an American-made Apache helicopter a couple of days ago. They're seeing all of these atrocities. They're seeing the billowing smoke coming out in different areas around Beirut 24/7, and this is the footage coming out. When nightfall happens, they're seeing these giant flashing bombs exploding around Beirut. That's what people are seeing because that's the reality on the ground. There are massive bombing campaigns going off there every single day carried out by the Israelis, and that's what people are seeing. It is the reality on the ground. That's why there's so much outrage, and that's why there's a huge disconnect to people in the West, but to the corporate media who basically run the rhetoric that you mentioned earlier that we see from CNN and Fox. We don't see the civilian casualties in Lebanon. We don't see the dead bodies, the babies with their heads shoot off, bombs, phosphorus weapons been used by the Israelis in southern Lebanon. People in the West don't see this, so then they don't understand why there's so much rage over here in the Middle East.
Dar, let's talk about the impression U.S. soldiers are making on the Arab world through operations in Iraq, which to some extent are also joint operations with Israel, as I understand it. Are some of the recent cases of U.S. soldiers getting arrested for atrocities impacting the views of Hamas or Hezbollah leaders as they take actions where Israel is concerned?
This is another very important point, and in fact, I did write a piece several months ago for Truthout called An Alliance of Violence, and I discussed the fact that when the Israeli military carries out operations in the occupied territories, there is almost immediate blowback in Iraq, let alone around the rest of the Arab world, but particularly in Iraq. The example I cite is when the Israeli military assassinated Sheikh Yassin, the leader of Hamas, down in Gaza on March 22, 2004. 9 days later, the four Blackwater security contractors were murdered in Fallujah, and that was a reprisal attack for Sheikh Yassin. There were pamphlets distributed at the scene that said very clearly, this is a revenge attack for Sheikh Yassin. Down with Israel, that's to Israel, this kind of thing going on at the scene of that attack. And of course, we all know what happened to the bodies of those contractors. Now we're seeing the same thing in Iraq. Just 2 days ago, Musad al-Sadr, the Shia cleric who's already had two intifadas against the U.S. military there, said, basically hinted very strongly that they will support Hezbollah, and there probably will be some fighting now coming out of the Mahdi army, his militia, against the U.S. and the British, and consequently, you know, there's been so much going on, excuse me if I get my days mixed up, but it was either yesterday or today, a British soldier was killed down just north of Basra, and another one was wounded. Well, that's Musad al-Sadr's Mahdi army. So, without a doubt, there's blowback happening in Iraq, and of course, also because of these atrocities you mentioned, there are Israeli mercenaries working in the prisons, doing interrogations, doing some of the torturing. Also, there are Israeli special forces in Iraq. They've been there from the beginning, and they also have a very strong presence in the northern region of Kurdistan. So, what's happening in Lebanon, let alone everything that I just mentioned in Iraq, is just pouring more fuel onto the fire. Really, it's important that people understand that Israel is not loved in the Arab world and in the Middle East, and if certainly if there were different policies of peace and coexistence and there was some fairness happening in the occupied territories, occupied by Israel, that is, there wouldn't be this. But the fact is, people here are all too aware that there is massive oppression going on in Palestine by the Israeli military, and this U.S. invasion of Iraq has heightened that awareness. and U.S. policy in Iraq coupled with Israeli policy in the Gaza Strip, for example, and now in Lebanon, is really just underscoring to everyone here how it's perceived is that the Israelis and the Americans will launch wars of aggression anytime they choose. They will use heavy-handed tactics to punish people. They will use collective punishment. They will violate the Geneva Conventions. There's nothing you can do about it. And that is the policy here. That's what people are seeing now today, clearer than ever before. And that's why there's so much outrage.
Dar Jamil, thanks so much for joining us on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, Dori.
Journalist Dar Jamil joined us from Damascus, Syria. He's been interviewing refugees from Lebanon and watching political developments there as Israeli F-16s bomb Lebanese cities and find sites along the Beirut to Damascus highway in the direction of Syria. You can read his latest stories, Fleeing Lebanese Speak of Indiscriminate Bombing, and Hezbollah, an Emerging Political Force, in Interpress News. You can read his other work in truthout.org or on his webpage, darjamilirak.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live every Wednesday at 5 p.m., TalkNation.org, and TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts and discussion at the New Cafe. Our music is by Fritz Heed, FritzHeed.com.
And now, for Making Waves' own Steve Diamond, with commentary on Lebanon and Israel, entitled, More Offensive Self-Defense.
More Offensive Self-Defense. Amid public outrage at Israel's massive killing of civilians in Lebanon, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, John Bolton, has stated that there is, quote, no moral equivalence between Hezbollah's terrorist rocket attacks into Israel and Israel's massive bombardment of Lebanon, and of course, he's right. Hezbollah fights mostly with primitive homemade rockets and has killed a few Israelis, half of them soldiers. Israel wields the latest in precision weapons supplied by the U.S. and has killed hundreds of Lebanese, 84% of whom were civilians, and a third of whom were children, while doing $2 billion in damage to Lebanon's civilian infrastructure. This razor-fine distinction that we are expected to use to justify this mass slaughter of the innocent is that we are to imagine Israel's aggression is really just self-defense, while Hezbollah, which was formed to resist Israel's policy of occupying Lebanon and Palestine, is simply engaging in random, mindless violence. Yet international law states that violent resistance to military occupation is justified. U.S. law states that military aid to Israel is not to be used to target civilians, and is not to be given to states that violate human rights, which the U.S. State Department confirms includes Israel. Yet the U.S. media uncritically echoes Bush claims that Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran are the aggressors in this conflict, and that the only path to peace starts with their absolute surrender and disarmament. Israel and its U.S. mouthpieces insist that it can't negotiate with terrorists, yet the captors of Israeli soldiers are clearly eager to organize trades for the release of some of the thousands of Palestinian and Lebanese political prisoners Israel continues to hold indefinitely. The basic issue here is that the U.S. and its client state Israel are pretending to try to protect themselves while actually engaging in nationalistic objectives and conquest. They've been hoping for an excuse for this for a long time. They are blowing up hundreds of Lebanese civilians for the crime of failing to force their government to start and lose a civil war with Hezbollah. Israel demands that Lebanon destroy Hezbollah on its behalf. If the Lebanese aren't doing enough to stop Hezbollah, then the American people certainly aren't doing enough to make their leaders, make Israel's leaders, stop warmongering on our behalf. You can find that with relevant links as an addendum to my column on nhindymedia.org. To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.